first case in the May reversal report is on page 6, Zhampolskaya or Zhampolskaya. It deals with the amendment of an affidavit of service. The Second Department reversed the Supreme Court, finding that although an affidavit of service can be amended, it cannot be amended to cure an erroneous address. The court wrote, an affidavit submitted by the defendant was sufficient to demonstrate that the address where service was alleged to have been effected in the affidavit of service was not, in fact, the address of defendant's actual place of business. Pursuant to CPLR 305 subdivision C, a court at any time in its discretion may allow any proof of service of a summons to be amended if a substantial right of a party against whom the summons is issued is not prejudiced. An erroneous address contained in an affidavit of service affects a defendant's substantial right to notice of the proceeding against him or her and may not be corrected by an amendment. So the takeaway, generally, if there's no prejudice, an affidavit of service may be amended, but it cannot be amended to correct the wrong address. Next is BEM versus Warwick Valley Central School District. There the plaintiffs had amended their bill of particulars, which they can do. They have a right to do it once without leave of court before the note of issue is filed. And here they sought to supplement or amend that amended bill of particulars, and the Supreme Court denied them permission for that second amendment or supplement. But the Second Department said they should have been allowed to supplement their amended bill of particulars because they were only seeking to amplify allegations made in their amended bill of particulars and to which there had been no objection by the opposing party. So the takeaway here, the plaintiffs were entitled to for permission to amend their supplemental bill of particulars only to the extent that the amendment amplified allegations already made without objection by the opposing party. The court noted that the reason for allowing amendment of bill of particulars is really to give the adverse party a more detailed picture of the claim, so there's no reason to deny a legitimate amplification of allegations already made without objection. Next is Cook on pages 7 and 8. Deals with the appropriate sanction for failure to provide discovery. Supreme Court had dismissed the complaint because of the plaintiff's attorney failing to provide discovery, but the Second Department reversed. The court wrote, the plaintiff's attorneys failed to comply with the defendant's demands for a bill of particulars and discovery, did not object to those demands, and did not respond in any way to follow-up communications from the defendant's attorneys until opposition to the motions was filed. In response to the motions, the plaintiff's attorneys failed to articulate any excuse for this series of failures. Notwithstanding this dereliction of responsibility, at the time the defendants moved to dismiss the complaint, the plaintiff was not in violation of any court-ordered deadlines. In fact, the defendants also both moved to compel the plaintiff to comply with their respective discovery demands by a date certain. And not long after the defendants' motions were filed, the plaintiff began to produce the requested materials with some deficiencies. Under these circumstances, we are of the view that reinstatement of the complaint conditioned upon the payment of a penalty by the plaintiff's trial counsel personally to both defendants would be more appropriate than the outright denial of plaintiff's right to a day in court. Next is the Madigan case on pages 8 and 9. It's another case that deals with the conduct of attorneys. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, found that plaintiff's counsel should have been found in criminal contempt for issuing subpoenas in defiance of Supreme Court's order staying any further action in the case. The court wrote, in contrast to civil contempt, because the purpose of criminal contempt is to vindicate the authority of the court, no showing of prejudice is required. Instead, allegations of willful disobedience of a proper judicial order strike at the core of the judicial process and implicate weighty public and institutional concerns regarding the integrity of and respect for judicial orders. Notwithstanding the court's order, the plaintiff's counsel issued subpoenas on 6 separate occasions. When Supreme Court reiterated the terms of the stay, both via interim relief granted in the order to show cause and in a separate order, the plaintiff's counsel did not desist, but instead served 4 more subpoenas and moved to compel the production of subpoenaed documents. This conduct evinces a lack of respect for judicial orders and warranted holding the plaintiff's counsel in criminal contempt. Under the circumstances, we deem the statutory maximum sanction of $1,000 per offense is warranted, and therefore impose a total sanction of $10,000. So the takeaway here, criminal contempt seeks to vindicate the authority of the court. Therefore, no showing of prejudice to the other side is required. And here, plaintiff's counsel issued subpoenas in defiance of an order of the court. A $10,000 sanction for criminal contempt was imposed on the attorney by the appellate court. Next is Allen. We are in the May 2022 civil procedure reversal report, and the next case is Allen on page 10. It deals with the procedure for requesting a change of venue. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant nursing home's motion to change venue should have been denied. Unless a party follows the special procedure in CPLR 511 subdivisions A and B, which requires making a demand on the other party before bringing a motion to change venue must be brought in the county where the action was started. Here, the defendant did not use the special procedure and brought the motion to change venue in the county where defendant sought to move the proceedings. That was the wrong county for the motion. So to reiterate, here the party made a motion to change venue in the county to which that party wanted venue changed. That was deemed the wrong county, and the motion was dismissed because the party didn't first use the special procedure in CPLR 511 subdivisions A and B, which requires making a demand on the other party before bringing the motion. Next is SH versus Diocese of Brooklyn, pages 11 and 12. It deals with the Child's Victim Act, which extends the statute of limitations for sexual abuse when the plaintiff was a child. Here, the alleged abuse took place in 1983 and 1984. This case presented an issue of first impression. Plaintiff is a Florida resident, and he alleged he was abused by a priest in Florida in 1983 and 1984, but he sued the Diocese of Brooklyn because he alleged the priest had committed sexual misconduct with children in Brooklyn and was transferred to Florida, where the abuse took place. Second Department held that the New York Child Victims Act, which is CPLR 214G, is not available to non-resident plaintiffs where the alleged acts of abuse occurred outside New York. CPLR 214G extends the statute of limitations to allow lawsuits by plaintiffs who were children at the time of the abuse. The Second Department determined CPLR 214G does not preclude the application of the borrowing statute, which is CPLR 202. Again, the plaintiff, a Florida resident, alleged the acts of abuse were committed in Florida in 1983 and 1984. Plaintiff alleged that the priest was transferred from the Diocese of Brooklyn to Florida Diocese in 1973 because of his sexual misconduct with children, hence the suit by the Florida plaintiff against the Diocese of Brooklyn. Because CPLR 214G, that's the Child Victims Act, extending the statute of limitations, does not apply, and CPLR 202, the borrowing statute, requires the application of Florida's four-year statute of limitations, plaintiff's suit is time-barred. Court wrote, under the circumstances of this case, CPLR 214G does not apply extraterritorially where the plaintiff is a non-resident and the alleged acts of sexual abuse were perpetrated by a non-resident outside of New York. Under these circumstances, the borrowing statute would apply, and since the plaintiff's action is time-barred in Florida, it would also be time-barred in New York, unless, as argued by the plaintiff, CPLR 214G precludes the application of the borrowing statute. We answer that question in the negative. Therefore, even if CPLR 214G applied extraterritorially, the plaintiff's action would be dismissed as time-barred pursuant to CPLR 202. So again, the Child Victims Act, which extends the statute of limitations for plaintiffs who were abused as children, does not apply to this Florida plaintiff who was allegedly abused in Florida. Plaintiff sued the Diocese of Brooklyn under the theory that the priest who abused him in Florida in 1983 and 84 was transferred to Florida from Brooklyn, allegedly because of sexual misconduct with children. New York's borrowing statute applied, rendering the action time-barred under Florida's four-year statute of limitations. Next is Schneier versus New York State Thruway Authority, a court of claims case against the state, which also has a notice of claim requirement. And this case involved the claimant's attempt to file a late notice of claim. Second Department, reversing the Court of Claims, held claimants should have been allowed to file a late notice of claim in this construction accident case. The delay in filing was minimal. Claimants made a sufficient showing the defendants were not prejudiced by the delay, and the defendants did not demonstrate prejudice. The court wrote, the claimant showed that any delay in ascertaining actual notice of all the essential facts underlying the claims was minimal, and that the defendants were provided with an adequate opportunity to investigate the circumstances underlying the claims in light of, among other things, the information contained in an accident report and a medical release, which were both prepared by the defendant's general contractor on the date of the accident. The defendants failed to come forward with a particularized evidentiary showing that they will be substantially prejudiced if the late claims are permitted. So the takeaway, the claimants adequately demonstrated defendants in this construction accident case were not prejudiced by the minimal delay in filing the notice of claim, and the defendants were unable to demonstrate any prejudice as they had time to investigate the incident after timely receiving the accident report. Claimant's motion for leave to file and serve a late notice of claim should have been granted. At this point, I'm going to insert a verification code, which is to be placed on your attorney affirmation. The verification code is Child Victims Act. Again, the first verification code in this April, May, June 2022 Civil Procedure Update CLE is Child Victims Act. Next is Matter of People of the State of New York versus the Trump Organization. It's on pages 13 and 14. It deals with whether civil discovery is available when there is a parallel criminal investigation. First Department, in this civil investigation by the Office of Attorney General, that's the OAG, into whether the Trump Organization committed fraud in their financial practices and disclosure, Supreme Court properly refused to quash the OAG's subpoenas seeking depositions and documents. The fact that there is also a criminal investigation does not preclude civil discovery. The court wrote, The existence of a criminal investigation does not preclude civil discovery of related facts at which a party may exercise the privilege against self-incrimination. Individuals have no constitutional or statutory right to be called to testify before a grand jury under circumstances that would give them immunity from prosecution for any matter about which they testify, although subjects of a grand jury proceeding have a statutory right to appear and testify. This right is conditioned upon the witness waiving the right to immunity and giving up the privilege against self-incrimination. That's Criminal Procedure Law 190.50, Subdivision 5. The political campaign and other public statements made by the Office of Attorney General about appellants do not support the claim that the Office of Attorney General initiated or is using the subpoenas in the civil investigation to obtain testimony solely for use in criminal proceeding or in a manner that would otherwise improperly undermine appellant's privilege against self-incrimination. Neither does the record suggest that in the absence of a civil investigation, the Attorney General would be likely to grant immunity to appellants, the primary subjects of the criminal investigation, to secure their grand jury testimony. Thus, the subpoenas did not frustrate any right to testify with immunity. So the takeaway, this case stems from the Office of Attorney General's fraud investigation of the Trump Organization. Supreme Court properly refused to quash the Attorney General's subpoenas. The fact that there is a related criminal investigation doesn't preclude civil discovery. There was no showing the appellant's privilege against self-incrimination was being undermined by the subpoenas seeking depositions and documents. Next is Wormser versus L'Oreal, pages 14 and 15. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiffs, that's Wormser's, action for breach of the forum selection clause seeking attorney's fees could go ahead. The court wrote, Plaintiff Wormser asserts a claim for breach of the forum selection clause, which requires disputes to be brought before the courts of New York City, and for attorney's fees incurred in the actions that defendant L'Oreal brought against it in New Jersey. After the New Jersey court's dismissal without prejudice, Wormser brought this action for breach of the forum selection clause. The court wrote, Wormser's claim is not barred by the doctrine of res judicata because the dismissal in New Jersey was without prejudice, therefore was not a final determination on the merits. Wormser's claim for attorney's fees may proceed as damages may be obtained for breach of a forum selection clause, and an award of such damages does not contravene the rule that deems attorney's fees a mere incident of litigation. So the two takeaways here, a dismissal without prejudice is not a final determination on the merits and is not therefore subject to the doctrine of res judicata, and the attorney's fees are properly demanded as damages in an action for breach of a forum selection clause. Next is Francois on pages 15 and 16. It deals with the requirement that a petition be verified. And this is in the context of the election law. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that petitioner's validating petition should not have been dismissed on the ground that the petition was not verified because, one, the respondents waived the issue by not objecting with due diligence, and two, although the exact words RE verification in CPLR 3021 were not used, the language used in the petition had the same effect as a verification. The court wrote, Section 16-116 of the election law requires that a special proceeding brought under Article 16 of the election law shall be heard upon a verified petition. The requirement is jurisdictional in nature. However, the objection to the alleged lack of verification of the validating petition was waived by the objector's failure to raise that objection with due diligence as required by CPLR 3022. The mere fact that a petition does not use the exact words set forth in CPLR 3021 does not mean that the petition is not verified, so long as the language used has the same effect as a verification. Here, the language used in the validating petition had the same effect as a verification, and the validating petition was verified, therefore, within the meaning of Election Law, Section 16-116. So the takeaway here, under the election law, a validating petition must be verified, and the absence of verification is a jurisdictional defect. But the failure to raise the issue with due diligence waives the objection pursuant to CPLR 3022. To constitute a valid verification, the exact language in CPLR 3021 need not be used. Here, the language in the validating petition, although not exactly as prescribed in CPLR 3021, was deemed sufficient to verify it. Next is Freeman. Freeman versus State of New York, pages 16 and 17. It deals with the unique requirements for expert witness disclosure in the Third Department. There, if the treating physician is going to testify, the expert witness disclosure rules apply to the treating physician. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that claimant's treating physician, whose name was Hobson, in this personal injury case, should have been allowed to testify as an expert despite the failure to comply with full expert disclosure pursuant to CPLR 3101. The Third Department is the only department which requires such full expert disclosure by a treating physician, and claimant's attorney had not practiced in the Third Department. Court wrote, "There's no dispute that claimant failed to comply with the expert disclosure requirements of CPLR 3101 Subdivision D in identifying Hobson as a witness. Nevertheless, we disagree with the Court of Claims finding that claimant's excuse was unreasonable." The situation here mirrors that in Schmidt versus Oneonta City School District, where we accepted the explanation of plaintiff's attorney that he was unaware of this court's interpretation of CPLR 3101 Subdivision D and the corresponding need to file an expert disclosure for the treating physician, and the record was otherwise devoid of any indication that counsel's failure to file such disclosure was willful. The same holds true here. As claimant's attorney revealed that she practices law in a different judicial department and candidly conceded she was unaware of this court's interpretation that the statute requires expert disclosure for treating physicians. There's nothing in the record calling into question the veracity of counsel's representations and no basis to conclude that noncompliance with CPLR 3101D was willful. The court erred in precluding Hobson's testimony as an expert witness. So the takeaway here, only in the Third Department are you required to provide full expert witness disclosure for a treating physician. Next is matter of Ockel. A family law case stands for two propositions. A party is not in default if the party's attorney appears, and because the attorney appeared and the party is not in default, an appeal is not precluded. Usually, if a party is in default, you can't bring an appeal. The Fourth Department, vacating the portions of the order entered on default, held that father's failure to appear was not a default because his counsel appeared, and because father was not in default, appeal was not precluded. The court wrote, "We agree with the father that family court erred in entering the order upon his default based on his failure to appear in court. The record establishes that the father was represented by counsel, and we have previously determined that where a party fails to appear in court on a scheduled date but is represented by counsel, the order is not one entered upon default of the aggrieved party, and appeal is not precluded." So again, when counsel appears in family court, the party represented by counsel is not in default. An appeal is therefore available to that party. Next is Aurora Loan Services on page 18. It's a foreclosure case and it deals with the lack of standing defense. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held that the bank in this foreclosure action was not required to affirmatively demonstrate standing and that the defendant to raise the issue must assert lack of standing as an affirmative defense. Merely denying the relevant allegations in the complaint is not enough. The court wrote, the plaintiff was not required to show its standing to maintain the action, whereas here, standing is not an essential element of the cause of action. Under CPLR 3018 subdivision B, a defendant must affirmatively plead lack of standing as an affirmative defense in the answer in order to properly raise the issue. The mere denial of the allegation that plaintiff was the owner and holder of the note and mortgage in the answer, without more, was insufficient to assert that the plaintiff lacks standing. So the takeaway, lack of standing in a foreclosure action is not part of the cause of action that the plaintiff has to prove, and therefore it must be raised as an affirmative defense by the defendant, and it's not enough simply to deny the relevant allegations in the complaint. Next is Batavia Townhouses, pages 19 and 20, Court of Appeals case dealing with revival of the statute of limitations in the context of a foreclosure or mortgage debt. The Court of Appeals, over an extensive two-judge dissent, held that the statute of limitations on the underlying foreclosure action was not told based upon acknowledgments of the mortgage debt in financial statements and tax returns. Rather, pursuant to General Obligations Law 17-105, only an express promise to pay the debt would revive an otherwise expired statute of limitations. The court wrote, the primary question presented by this appeal is which section of Article 17 of the General Obligations Law governs the tolling or revival of the statute of limitations period in an action pursuant to Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1501. RPAPL, that's Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1501, Subdivision 4, allows a party to cancel a mortgage where the limitations period for commencing a foreclosure action has expired. We hold that General Obligations Law, Section 17105, not Section 17101, governs whether the statute of limitations has been tolled or revived in such an action. Under General Obligations Law 17105, the partnerships, that's the mortgagee's actions in this case, could only toll or revive the statute of limitations for the mortgagor to bring the foreclosure action if the mortgagee made an express promise to pay the mortgage debt. Accordingly, the appellate division, this is a court of appeals case, correctly concluded that the partnership's delivery of its financial statements and tax returns to the mortgagor did not meet the requirements of Section 17105 because they were not express promises to pay the mortgage debt. So the takeaway here, references to the mortgage debt in financial statements and tax returns provided to the mortgagor by the mortgagee did not revive or toll the statute of limitations on the underlying foreclosure action. Pursuant to General Obligations Law 17105, only an express acknowledgement of the mortgage would revive the action. Next is Matter of Brennan on pages 20 and 21. It deals with a good faith effort to file and serve opposition papers that didn't succeed. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held that petitioner's motion to vacate an order dismissing the petition issued after Supreme Court refused to consider petitioner's opposition papers should have been granted. Petitioner had made a good faith effort to timely file and serve the papers and demonstrated a potentially meritorious cause of action. The court wrote, The petitioner, who had until July 13, 2018, to submit opposition papers to the respondent's motion, filed pro se opposition papers with the court on July 13, 2018. He failed, however, to properly serve the respondents with a copy of the opposition papers or to provide the court with the proper proof of service. The petitioner did file with the court a defective affidavit of service in which dates of service were blank and which were neither signed nor notarized. A copy of the opposition papers that the petitioner had emailed to the respondents was later discovered in the junk email folder of the respondent's counsel. Clearly, the petitioner made a good faith, albeit unsuccessful, attempt to timely respond to the motion, and the court should have considered the absence of any evidence that the petitioner's default was intentional, made in bad faith, or with an intent to abandon the action. The petitioner's arguments in support of the amended petition demonstrate a potentially meritorious cause of action. The respondents have neither alleged nor established that they would be prejudiced by vacating the default and hearing the matter on the merits. So the takeaway here, petitioner's good faith effort to timely file and serve his opposition papers demonstrated he did not intend to abandon the action. Supreme Court should not have refused to consider his opposition papers before issuing its order dismissing the petition. The order, therefore, should have been vacated. Next is Binder on page 21. Just makes clear that a court generally should not, acting on its own, sua sponte, dismiss a complaint. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held the judge should not have sua sponte dismissed the complaint because there were no extraordinary circumstances. Supreme Court erred in sua sponte directing dismissal of the complaint. A court's power to dismiss a complaint sua sponte is to be used sparingly and only when extraordinary circumstances exist to warrant dismissal. Here, although the plaintiff's submissions were insufficient to demonstrate his entitlement to a default judgment, no extraordinary circumstances existed to warrant dismissal of the complaint. So the takeaway, absent so-called extraordinary circumstances, a judge doesn't have the authority to sua sponte, acting on his own or her own, dismiss a complaint. And here, although the plaintiff's evidence was not sufficient to support a default judgment, that insufficiency didn't rise to extraordinary circumstances which would justify a sua sponte dismissal of the complaint. Next is Mayada, M-A-G-A-D-A, Incorporated, on page 22. It has two distinct issues. What is the effect of a limited liability company's failure to change its address on file with the Secretary of State? And what is the effect of a list pendants on parties who take possession of the property when the list pendants has been filed? The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held one, defendant ENA did not show a reasonable excuse for its default, that's the limited liability company, and two, the parties to which the property was transferred after the list pendants was filed were not necessary parties to this action because they're bound by the result of this action. The court wrote, ENA asserted that it did not receive the summons and complaint which had been served on the Secretary of State because it had failed to keep its address updated. However, where a defendant does not receive service of process because it failed to keep a current address on file with the Secretary of State, courts will not find a reasonable excuse for the default. Supreme Court should have denied ENA, that's the limited liability company's cross motion, as it sought to join as defendants the parties who purchased the property from ENA. Those parties need not be joined to accord complete relief or to avoid an inequitable effect, that's CPLR 1001 subdivision A, They are bound by all proceedings taken in the action to the same extent as a party, because their conveyances were recorded after the filing of the notice of pendency, and that cites CPLR 6501. So the practice point, a limited liability corporation's failure to change the address on file with the Secretary of State is not an acceptable excuse for default. And the second point, because a list pendants was filed against the defendant's property here, the parties to which the property was subsequently transferred are bound by the result of this action and are not, therefore, necessary parties to this action. Next is Aloisio on page 23. It's a long-arm jurisdiction case. First Department reversing Supreme Court held that New York did not have jurisdiction over BSB, a Bavarian stem donor registry. The court wrote, BSB was contacted through a chain of interactions between donor registries that began with decedent's New York physicians reaching out to the National Marrow Donor Program in Minnesota to find a match for decedent so that she could undergo a bone marrow transplant to treat leukemia. When no such match was found there, the search was expanded, including to Republic of Germany's Central Registry, and ultimately a donor was located in the BSB registry, that's the Bavarian registry. BSB did not engage in a regular course of conduct, nor did it purposefully avail itself of the privilege of conducting activities within New York State. Furthermore, BSB, a 20-employee not-for-profit organization, was reimbursed with a set sum by a German entity for providing the donation to Decedent's Transplant Center's courier in Germany, and reimbursement was not contingent on decedent's ability to pay, insurance, or the like. There's no evidence that BSB derived substantial revenue from the transaction or from New York, where it has no offices, employees, agents, marketing, registrations, or presence. Even if the long-arm statute applied, BSB does not have the minimum context necessary such that it should reasonably have expected to be brought into court here. So the takeaway, a Bavarian stem donor registry did not have sufficient contacts with New York to allow New York to exercise long-arm jurisdiction over the registry. The registry played a role in decedent's physician's search for bone marrow match to treat decedent's leukemia. The registry had no presence in New York and did not purposefully conduct activities in New York. Even if the long-arm statute applied, the registry did not have the minimum contacts with New York that are required under a separate due process analysis. Next is the English case on pages 24 and 25. It's another long-arm jurisdiction case. The First Department held that New York had specific long-arm jurisdiction of defendant Schulten, the manufacturer and distributor of talcum powder alleged to have caused plaintiff's peritoneal mesothelioma. Plaintiff, English, was a flight attendant for 30 years who used the talcum powder when she stayed in New York. Schulten has its principal place of business in New Jersey, but has an office in New York and markets the product in New York. The court wrote, English, a Texas resident, was employed as a flight attendant for 33 years from 1966 to 1999. During a substantial part of that time, she used Desert Flower on a daily basis after showering. From 1966 to 1984, English was regularly assigned to flights into New York and flew into this state 2 to 4 times a month. She usually remained in New York on 2 or 3 day layovers. When English traveled, she packed Desert Flower in her luggage so she would have it available for use when she showered. There's no claim that the Desert Flower English used in New York was purchased in New York. Schulten is incorporated in New Jersey, where it had its principal place of business during the time that English claims to have used Desert Flower. Schulten never manufactured Desert Flower in New York. And in the mid-1970s, the manufacture of its talc products shifted from Tennessee to New Jersey. Desert Flower was marketed nationally, including in New York. During the relevant period of time, Shulton maintained a New York office from which it conducted its marketing activities for cosmetics and toiletries. The New York office was also headquarters for its international division. Shulton's maintenance of its own New York office satisfies the first prong under CPLR 302 subdivision A1. Desert Flower was marketed and sold nationally, and English used Desert Flower when she traveled to and while she stayed in New York. Shulton's activities and contacts with New York and the allegedly hazardous talcum powder used by English are sufficient to support an assertion of specific jurisdiction over Shulton. So the takeaway, even though plaintiff was a Texas resident and the company she was suing was based in New Jersey, she was able to sue using New York courts. Plaintiff was a flight attendant for 30 years with monthly stayovers in New York. Defendant had an office in New York and marketed the talcum powder which allegedly caused plaintiff's mesothelioma nationwide. Next is Wells Fargo on page 25. It deals with the requirements for motions to renew or successive summary judgment motions. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the bank's motion in this foreclosure action did not fit the criteria for a motion to renew or an allowable successive summary judgment motion. Therefore, the judgment of foreclosure should not have been granted. The court wrote, when no reasonable justification is given for failing to present new facts on the prior motion, the Supreme Court lacks discretion to grant renewal. Here, the plaintiff failed to provide any justification for its failure to present the new evidence supporting its renewal motion as part of its prior motion. Even considered as a successive motion for summary judgment, such a motion should not be entertained in the absence of good cause, such as a showing of newly discovered evidence. So the takeaway, attempting to bring a second motion, which includes new facts, without a reasonable justification for leaving them out of the first motion, does not fit the criteria for a motion to renew or an allowable successive summary judgment motion. Next is IS Christie Management on page 26. It deals with something that comes off quite often, whether the complaint actually states distinct causes of action for breach of contract and fraud. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the fraud cause of action was not duplicative of the breach of contract cause of action and should not have been dismissed. The court wrote, the fraud claim is not duplicative of the contract claim. This is not a case where the only fraud alleged was the defendant's unkept promise to perform certain of its pre-existing obligations under the party's contract. Rather, plaintiff alleges, whenever defendant's services for plaintiff proved to be deficient, defendant would purport to deal with the problem and then misrepresent to plaintiff that the problem had been fixed when it had not. Unlike a misrepresentation of future intent to perform, a misrepresentation of present facts is collateral to the contract and therefore involves a separate breach of duty. Plaintiff seeks at least some damages on its fraud claim that it does not seek on its contract claim. So the takeaway, fraud causes of action are often dismissed as duplicative of breach of contract causes of action. Here, the fraud cause of action should not have been dismissed because the misrepresentation made by the defendant allegedly concerned present facts, not a future intent to perform. In addition, the complaint sought damages for fraud that were not sought for breach of contract. Next is Schlüsselberg versus New York Century Mutual Fire Insurance Company on pages 27 and 28. It deals with the criteria for punitive damages. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the punitive damages claim against the defendant insurer should have been dismissed. Plaintiff was struck by a vehicle when she was in a crosswalk. She settled with the driver's insurer with her insurer's consent for $25,000. She then brought this breach of contract action against the defendant insurer for $225,000 plus punitive damages for a bad faith breach of the insurance contract. The elements required to state a claim for punitive damages when the claim arises from a breach of contract are: 1. The defendant's conduct must be actionable as an independent tort. 2. The tortious conduct must be of the egregious nature set forth in Walker v. Sheldon, that's 10 New York 2nd 401. 3. The egregious conduct must be directed to the plaintiff. And 4. It must be part of a pattern directed at the public generally. Where a lawsuit has its genesis in the contractual relationship between the parties, the threshold task for a court considering a defendant's motion to dismiss a demand for punitive damages is to identify a tort independent of the contract. The plaintiff failed to allege an independent tort. There's no separate tort for bad faith refusal to comply with an insurance contract. While an insurer may be held liable for damages to its insured for the bad faith refusal of a settlement offer, the plaintiff here failed to state such a cause of action. The plaintiff has not alleged any facts from which an inference can be drawn that the defendant's conduct constituted a gross disregard of the plaintiff's interests. The plaintiff failed to allege any facts from which an inference can be drawn that the defendant's conduct was of an egregious nature as set forth in Walker v. Sheldon, such that it was morally reprehensible and of such wanton dishonesty as to imply a criminal indifference to civil obligations. So the takeaway here, the criteria for punitive damages for breach of contract are difficult to meet. The defendant's conduct must amount to an independent tort, be morally reprehensible, wantonly dishonest, and criminally indifferent to civil obligations. Here, those criteria were not met by the allegations of the breach of an insurance contract. Next is the Renfro case on pages 28 and 29, and it deals with a lis pendens and asks the question whether the lis pendens can reach personal property as opposed to real property. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was no relationship between plaintiff's action seeking the assets of a joint venture and the ownership of the real property associated with the joint venture, which was to be used as an inn. Therefore, defendant's motion to cancel the lis pendens should have been granted. The court wrote, "A notice of pendency may be filed in any action in a court of the state or of the United States in which the judgment demanded would affect the title to or the possession, use, or enjoyment of real property." That's CPLR 6501. Because the provisional remedy of a notice of pendency is an extraordinary privilege, the Court of Appeals has held that to be entitled to that remedy, there must be a direct relationship between the relief sought in the complaint and the title to or possession of the disputed property. In making that determination, a court must use a narrow interpretation, and its analysis is to be limited to the pleading's face. Supreme Court erred in denying the motion insofar as it sought to cancel the notice of pendency because there was no direct relationship between the title to or possession of the property and the relief sought by the plaintiff. We modify the order accordingly. Reviewing the complaint on its face, we conclude that the plaintiff seeks merely to enforce her 50% share of the joint venture and does not assert an interest in the property itself. The complaint alleges that title to the property was at all relevant times held by Properties LLC, of which plaintiff was not a member. It is well settled that the legal consequences of a joint venture are equivalent to those of a partnership, and thus a joint venturer's interest in a joint venture constitutes an interest in only personal property, not real property, thereby precluding recourse to a notice of pendency. So the takeaway here, partnership law applies to joint ventures. Here the joint venture was the operation of an inn. Plaintiff sought the assets of the joint venture, which involves only personal property, not real property. Plaintiff had no interest in the real property, the inn. Therefore, the list pendants filed by the plaintiff should have been canceled. Next is Matter of Nemeth, pages 29 and 30. It involves the statute of limitations and the relation back doctrine in the context of a use variance. The Third Department held that the relation back doctrine did not save the petition challenging a use variance. The initial petition was dismissed for failure to name a necessary party, whose name was Rosa. The subsequent amended petition, which included the necessary party, was dismissed as time barred. The court wrote, Supreme Court correctly held the petitioners are not entitled to the benefit of the relation back doctrine. The doctrine permits a petitioner to amend a petition to add a respondent even though the statute of limitations has expired at the time of the amendment, so long as the petitioner can demonstrate three things. One, that the claims arose out of the same occurrence. Two, that the later added respondent is united in interest with a previously named respondent. And three, that the later added respondent knew or should have known that but for a mistake by the petitioners, the proceeding would have also been brought against him or her. Petitioners simply cannot meet the third and final condition and therefore cannot avail themselves of the doctrine. Rosa was appropriately named as a respondent and identified as the landowner of the subject property in petitioner's successful challenge to the use variance issued in 2013. This is simply not an instance where the identity of a respondent was in doubt or there was some question regarding that party's status. So the takeaway here in the context of a zoning matter, the use variance, here a necessary party was not named in the petition and the petition was dismissed for that reason. The amended petition, which named the necessary party, was time barred. The relation back doctrine could not be invoked to save the amended petition because the identity of the necessary party was known to the petitioners who had named her in a related petition years ago. Next is Douglas on page 31. It has two distinct issues. It deals with evidence first presented in a reply paper, and it deals with the relationship between a labor law construction accident case and workers' compensation. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court in this construction accident case, held plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on his labor law 241 subdivision 6 cause of action should not have been granted because it was based upon information raised for the first time in reply. The First Department noted that Supreme Court properly found that the ruling in plaintiff's workers' compensation case collaterally estopped plaintiff from claiming traumatic brain injury and cognitive disorder in this labor law action. The court wrote, Supreme Court should have denied plaintiff's motion for summary judgment with respect to labor law 241-6, which was based on an expert affidavit submitted in reply. The affidavit, which constituted the first time plaintiff asserted violations of the New York Code of Rules and Regulations, section 23-2.2, was not addressed to the arguments made in defendant's opposition and instead sought to assert new grounds for the motion. Plaintiff is collaterally estopped from litigating his allegation that he sustained traumatic brain injury and cognitive disorder since the allegation was previously raised and conclusively decided against him in a workers' compensation board proceeding where plaintiff had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue. So the takeaway here, evidence first presented in reply and which does not address anything raised by the other party's opposition papers should not be considered by the court. And a ruling in a workers' compensation case Here, rejecting the worker's traumatic brain injury and cognitive disorder claims may preclude the same claims in a labor law action pursuant to the collateral estoppel doctrine. Next is Abel Naga on page 32. It deals with the application of the doctrine of res judicata. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the fraudulent conveyance cause of action was precluded by the doctrine of res judicata. Although the fraudulent conveyance claim was not alleged in the prior action, which was dismissed, it could have been raised in the prior action. The court wrote, in 2016, plaintiffs sued NBC, NBF, and PIM, alleging, as she does in the instant action, that NBC and NBF were PIM's alter egos. In August 2018, Supreme Court granted NBC and NBF's motion to dismiss that action. While the prior action did not allege fraudulent conveyance, the doctrine of res judicata bars plaintiff from raising that claim here because she could have raised it in the prior action. Plaintiff learned on or about May 9, 2017, that non-party Conquest Capital Group had repurchased the equity it had previously sold to PIM. She filed an amended complaint in the prior action on May 26, 2017. Although plaintiff alleges that she did not discover the price at which Conquest repurchased its equity until November 2018, she could have learned this fact earlier by making inquiries. So the takeaway here, the doctrine of res judicata precludes causes of action which could have been investigated and raised in a prior action. Next is Erie County Employees Retirement System. It's on page 33, and it deals with the requirements for alleging fraud, but this in the special circumstance of a securities case. The First Department held that plaintiffs who purchased securities based upon allegedly inaccurate information in defendant's secondary public offering, that's an SPO, stated causes of action for violations of the Securities Act. The court noted that the heightened pleading requirements of CPLR 3015 subdivision B do not apply to the Securities Act violations alleged in the complaint. The court wrote, claims for violations of Section 11, 12, and 15 of the Securities Act of 1933, that's a federal statute, 15 U.S.C. Section 77K, and other sections as well, are not subject to the heightened pleading requirements of CPLR 3016B. The alleged misstatements in the SPO cannot be deemed forward-looking or mere puffery as a matter of law, because the complaint alleges that defendants knew at the time of the SPO that present facts rendered statements in the SPO misleading or false. The generic boilerplate risk warnings in the offering documents do not shield defendants from liability. Plaintiff adequately alleges that once defendants spoke about its significant exposure to emerging markets in Asia, it was obligated to disclose the whole truth, namely that its mobile solutions business in China was actually experiencing a sharp decline at the time of the SPO. So the takeaway here, the heightened pleading requirements for fraud in CPLR 3016 do not apply to the causes of action here alleging violations of the Securities Act, allegedly misleading information in a secondary public offering. Next is the Colt case on pages 34 and 35. It deals with two distinct issues, sovereign immunity and the forum nonconvenience doctrine. The First Department, over an extensive two-justice dissenting opinion, held that the doctrine of sovereign immunity did not require the dismissal of plaintiff's suit against the New Jersey Transit Corporation, NJT, in this bus pedestrian accident case. Plaintiff was struck by the NJT bus in New York. The plaintiff, under New Jersey law, could not sue in New Jersey because the cause of action did not arise in New Jersey. The first department held that the forum non conveniens criteria provided an appropriate analytical framework. At this point, I'm going to insert the second verification code that's to be placed on your attorney affirmation. The second verification code for this April, May, June 2022 Civil Procedure Update CLE is forum. Again, the second verification code for this April, May, June 2022 Civil Procedure Update CLE is forum. Okay, getting back to the Colt case, which again is on pages 34 and 35. It's the plaintiff was struck by a New Jersey Transit Corporation bus in New York, and New Jersey law would not allow the plaintiff to sue in New Jersey because the action didn't arise in New Jersey. So the first department was faced with trying to analyze this case, and they decided to analyze it under the forum non conveniens criteria. So the court wrote, "We have previously held that New Jersey Transit is an arm of the state of New Jersey, and that as such, it is entitled to invoke the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Should we dismiss a personal injury action on the ground of sovereign immunity when the action cannot be convinced in the sovereign's own courts because the injury arose outside of the sovereign's borders? We resolve this issue by analogizing it to the legal framework for the forum non conveniens doctrine. Among the factors to consider in determining whether to dismiss an action under this doctrine, with no single factor controlling, are the burden on New York courts, the potential hardship to the defendant, the availability of an alternate forum in which the plaintiff may bring suit, the residency of the parties, the forum in which the cause of action arose, and the extent to which the party's interest may otherwise be properly served by pursuing the claim in New York. So, using those criteria, the First Department determined that the plaintiff could bring the action in New York. The takeaway: a bus operated by the New Jersey Transit Corporation struck the plaintiff in New York. New Jersey Transit is an arm of the state of New Jersey to which the sovereign immunity doctrine applies, but under New Jersey law, the suit cannot be brought in New Jersey. After analyzing the case using the forum non conveniens criteria, the First Department allowed the New York lawsuit to go forward. And the final case, Deutsche Bank, on page 35-36, deals with a notice of appearance. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant waived any claim of a lack of personal jurisdiction. The plaintiff, rejecting defendant's answer as untimely, indicated the answer was deemed to be a notice of appearance, which is the equivalent of personal service of the summons. The court wrote, an appearance of the defendant is equivalent to personal service of the summons upon him or her unless an objection to jurisdiction pursuant to CPLR 3211 is asserted by motion or in the answer. Here the plaintiff submitted evidence that the defendant served an answer upon it on or about January 20th, 2015, that answer did not assert the defense of lack of personal jurisdiction. The plaintiff rejected the answer as untimely and advised the defendant that it would deem the untimely answer a notice of appearance by the defendant. The defendant did not object to the plaintiff's treating her untimely answer as a notice of appearance. The defendant did not assert lack of personal jurisdiction until moving pursuant to CPLR 3211 to dismiss the complaint more than 2 years later. Therefore, she waived the defense of lack of personal jurisdiction. So the takeaway here, defendant's late answer was rejected by the plaintiff, but the plaintiff informed the defendant that it considered the late answer to be a notice of appearance. Defendant didn't object. An appearance is equivalent to the service of summons. Therefore, defendant waived the lack of personal jurisdiction defense. So that concludes the May reversal report, civil procedure reversal report for May 2022, and we will move on to the final reversal report in the CLE, the June 2022 reversal report.